You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 15th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jane Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, friends.
Hello,
good evening,
everybody.
Everyone.
Hello.
This is show 3, 2014. The science or fiction stats so far this year.
Okay.
Oh,
so
we're my
right
God.
To the important stuff.
I don't see why we need to even talk
Rebecca,
about this. Right
Rebecca,
now.
Let's
Jay.
Let him do it. I have won every science or fiction this year. Rebecca has lost all of them.
Uh-huh.
And I think Evan and Bob are what? One?
They're 50-50.
50-50, okay. Just, you know, keeping things
right. And what, you know what number episode this is for us?
400.
Far.
444.
Oh, boy. What does it mean?
Well, in Asian cultures, the number 4 is the symbol of death.
Bad luck. Yeah.
So this is triple death, this episode.
So this is worse than 666 to them.
Well,
awesome.
Yeah. Two-thirds of the way to 666.
That's
right. I like that.
This is officially our triple death episode. Thank you.
Man.
Rebecca.
So
speaking of people who died, happy birthday to Jacob Bronowski. I should have gone with somebody who died today, but I did not plan ahead. So instead, we get a birthday, although he is dead. January 18th, 1908, Dr. Jacob Bronowski was born. He is probably best known as the presenter and the writer of a TV miniseries called The Ascent of Man, which is a really awesome documentary series that inspired Cosmos, Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the people who worked on Cosmos also worked first on The Ascent of Man. So Bronowski was a mathematician and a biologist, and he was also very much interested in the arts. He was a poet. He specifically wanted to look at how the sciences are impacted by the arts and vice versa. He flatly rejected a lot of what Hume had to say about art and science being distinct worlds that didn't overlap. He was a humanist, a very open humanist, who was very interested in how science can better humanity, and sometimes he looked at how science could make the world a worse place. He's very interested in things like the Holocaust. He lost a lot of his family in the Holocaust, and he also studied the biology of what happened in Japan after we dropped the bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And he was horrified by all of that and wanted to see how science could make the world a better place and how science could impact ethics and vice versa. So he's a really interesting guy. And if you're interested in seeing what he had to say about stuff, pretty much the entire, I think you can find the whole Ascent of Man series on YouTube. Or you can buy it on DVD. And there's a book that's pretty much just a word-for-word reprinting of the what he said in the TV series.
Yeah, very cool. I have childhood memories of watching The Ascent of Man. I don't know if they're real or not, but I do.
Well, you can rewatch it on YouTube and
yeah,
see
I think I
if
will.
It is as you remember.
It's like Carl Sagan with the British accent. You know, what's not to love? So talking about how science can benefit civilization, Bob, you're going to tell us about the advent of self-cleaning clothing.
good one, Steve. We may actually be at the beginning of a revolution in clothing. And no, it's not heated clothing, which is taking way too long and would have been nice for the polar vortex. Thank you very much. But no, this latest advance is an interesting one. It has to do with keeping clothing dry and stain-free, which is nice too, I guess. A team of scientists from the Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences and the Wise Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering, how cool is that, have improved the versatility of their technology to include common clothing like cotton and polyester. Now, this technology is called SLIPS, for slippery, liquid-infused, porous surfaces, and it's much more robust and can handle a wider variety of nasty liquids than anything that's come before it. And so what we're talking about here is essentially super hydrophobicity. That's a fancy and very cool way to say that something is very, very, very difficult to wet. So if you break the word down, it's pretty easy to understand. Hydro refers to water. Phobic is a version of the word phobia, which we all know. And super just means that it's so awesome that it can wear a cape. Now, conversely, if these services loved water, it would be called, Steve?
Hydrophilic.
Yeah, super hydrophilic. And that might be a great quality for a sponge, but not for your t-shirt. So one reason this tech is so cool is that it's inspired by nature. It's biomimetic. Now, the previous state of the art was inspired by the super hydrophobic lotus leaf. And they're really cool. If you pour water on a lotus leaf, it just beads up and rolls right off, taking any dirt or any contaminants that might be on it. And this is due to the nanotextures that are on the surface of the leaf. And these nanostructures are surrounded by air, causing the water to behave this way. But there's shortcomings though, because that air layer around the structures has to be very stable. So therefore, if there's like a really heavy rain or there's heavy twisting or rubbing, then the super hydro, phobic, super hydrophobic nature of the material.
It's probably phobitudinosity.
Yeah. Okay. well, whatever that is, it fails. And it fails just when you really need it. So it's not good for extremes of wetness and abrasion. So, it's also not good with organic, low surface tension liquids like oil. And oil doesn't bead up like water. It spreads itself very, very thin. You could actually take a thimbleful of oil and put it into like a large, like say a pool, and it would actually spread to cover the entire pool. It gets incredibly thin.
Would you get thin film interference?
Yes. You read my mind. So that's
I know you by now, Bob.
Yeah, I know. That's what actually creates those beautiful rainbow colors. As Steve said, it's thin film interference or iridescence.
Why would a plant need this?
Actually, there's selective pressure for this because it's a really great advantage for inhibiting the growth of things like algae or fungi on the plant. And also the water rolls off. Which is self-cleaning, like I said, but it also takes that dirt with it and other things so that those things can actually inhibit photosynthesis. So that's a big plus for any type of plant that develops this quality. So what's new with the SLIPS technology is it's not based on a lotus leaf though. It's inspired by my favorite type of plant, carnivorous plants. And I'm specifically referring to the pitcher plant. You've all seen this, guys, right? Insects are attracted to, it's like a bulb-shaped plant, and when the insect lands on it, it essentially just hydroplanes right down inside it into the nasty digestive juices on the inside.
Insects go in, but they don't come out.
Yeah, right. So that's a super hydrophobic material as well. The inside of the plant has this quality because it infuses water into the outer coating of the interior, making it just basically slick as hell. So SLIPS does the same exact thing. It attaches this, the technique is to attach a special coating to whatever the desired material is. In this case, we're talking about materials, textiles, but you could do it to lots of different things. So that coating is infused with water and it'll repel almost any liquid, anything, you know, water-based, ice, oil, salt, wax, blood, etc. Not only that though, the big advance here though with SLIPS is that with clothing is that it'll be able to handle all these sorts of extreme situations like a torrential downpour or physical abuse without losing any of those qualities. So that's really the crux of this entire advance here is that quality, which is really big. But of course there's a downside, right? There's always a downside. This one isn't terrible per se, I guess. Some fabrics weren't as breathable as the researchers would have liked, they said. Yeah, that could be important for some materials, you know, because for a lot of different textiles, breathability is a key trait that you don't want to lose. So that could be a little bit of a bummer, but apparently they're optimistic that they will eventually be able to get around that. But even if they can't, there would still be some interesting applications for this. Not even textile based. It would be, you know, they can use it, to prevent ice formation on refrigeration coils. They could inhibit bacteria from making homes on things like medical devices. All great applications. But for textiles, the first applications will probably be for things where breathability is not a key requirement.
So not socks.
Yeah, not socks. But things like in the medical and, you know, military fields, you know, if you deal with biohazards or dangerous liquids, I'm sure you'd love to have your lab coat coated with this stuff, or perhaps your tactical or hazard suits, or even maybe some kind of specialty clothing that you have for your construction or your manufacturing job.
Yeah.
So,
how about t-shirts worn in a wet t-shirt contest?
Oh my God.
I guess that would be the worst application.
You would lose
that contest, Steve.
Yeah.
Bob.
Yeah.
So products are already out, like Never Wet, the Rust-Oleum thing that made the news. And there are a lot of problems with it. Like, it's a fun party trick, but reviews have said that it flakes off really easily. Like, you could spray it on a t-shirt or something and it's cool. You can drop ketchup right on it, but once you wash it a couple of times, it's gone. Also, it leaves like a white coating on everything. So everything has to be white. Like, are those things that are being fixed?
Well, you know, I remember months ago seeing, a YouTube video for that kind of stuff. And I'm not sure what, technique that spray is based on. I don't know if it's based on, the lotus effect, the lotus leaf effect. I doubt they're using this new technology. And that's sprayed on. My take on this, although they weren't very specific, was that this would be part of the manufacturing process of the textiles themselves.
Did they mention how long it'll last?
No, but I think it would last quite a while because it's designed to take abuse. It's designed to be rubbed and twisted and all sorts of stuff. That's kind of like the hallmark of this technology. So I think this is very different.
I know all about
that, yeah. Yeah, I think this is very different from the stuff you're talking about, Rebecca. And yeah, I saw the same thing and I remember thinking, oh, this is so awesome. And then I realized, wait, how come everything they're treating is white? And then you hear the real world applications of people like, you know, this is kind of expensive and it doesn't last long and blah, blah, blah. So this is a different beast, I believe.
Yeah, but this is like the bigger picture. We see this all the time. Some new technology and has some interesting feature, some really useful feature. But there are these problems with it that the researchers assure us will eventually be fixed, but then we never hear from them again. You know, it's always like, show me when you got an actual working product, not just some interesting demonstration, you know. This applies across
the
board.
I was impressed that Never Wet hit the shelves as quickly as it did. Like, after I saw that video, I'm like, oh, we're never going to see this. And I was like, oh, wait, it's on the shelves in Home Depot next month, you know?
Yep. But, I remember that.
Yeah. A little too good to be true still, but.
Now, I'm waiting for my carbon nanofiber clothing.
Yeah, you'd think that would be not far.
They just have a couple of problems I got to work out. All right.
I'm waiting for the nanotech.
5 years.
5 years. 5 years, yeah.
5 to 10 years.
So, Evan, tell us why radiation from Fukushima is going to kill all of us.
If it hasn't already, how do we really know?
Maybe we're all dead.
Yeah.
We're zombies.
This
is the Triple Death podcast, so.
It is.
Death number one,
so
Fukushima.
So you never know. And speaking of which, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, you remember it began in 2011, March 11th, 2011, an undersea earthquake triggered massive tsunami waves. The waves crashing along the shorelines of Japan in some places reached heights of over 130 feet. And when the waves came crashing ashore at the power plant, the 60-foot waves at Fukushima easily breached the 35-foot seawall protecting the plant. So it enveloped the entire complex. In fact, water made its way as far as 6 miles inland. And what happened is it caused primary and secondary emergency power systems at the plant to fail.
And tertiary, now, those power systems. Tertiary. The backups of the backups failed as well.
They absolutely did. Everything failed. There was nothing left for a while. The power systems were needed to pump water, which was used to cool the fuel rods. So for a time, the rods could not be cooled, and therefore, what do you have? You got a meltdown. Chemicals, gases build up, and before long, a catastrophic failure was underway, and a failure in which radioactive materials were released into the ocean and into the surrounding lands. Now, understandably, the people of Japan were and are still extremely concerned about this. They've been devastated by it. They're on a very long road still getting back to what might be considered normal. And in this tragedy, tens of thousands of people died or are missing as a result of the tsunami. So it's, you know, emotionally, it's just really still a terrible time for the people of Japan. But in a way, also understandably, there's no shortage of fear and misunderstanding by people all over the world about the breadth and severity of the radiation leak at Fukushima. And in some cases, it gets downright conspiratorial in its tone and its substance. One of the more recent and popular examples of this fear and misunderstanding is a YouTube video titled "Fukushima Radiation Hits San Francisco" from December of 2013. And this story made headlines coast to coast just a few weeks ago. Now, in the video, a person with a Geiger counter is walking around a beach in Half Moon Bay, California, and he's taking radiation readings. He's talking as the video plays, but to make it brief, here's his written description of the video under his YouTube account. It reads, "Background radiation reading 30 CPM. CPM means counts per minute. Near the ocean, it's 150 CPM. The moisture coming from the ocean wave seems to be what's making the Geiger counter jump up 5 times. This is not normal at all. More thorough testing needs to be done." And in a blog entry by the same guy who's unidentified, he claims he's been monitoring the local beaches for 2 years before noticing the sudden rise in radiation levels in the recent days leading up to the video he shot on December 23rd. So now I don't think this guy who shot the video is the problem here. There's nothing wrong in of itself to keep track of, you know, radiations in the place you live, you know, and work. I have a radon abatement system in my house because my house in the basement, it's an older house, and the radon levels are slightly above the recommended limit. So does that make me some sort of paranoid crazy person? No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just said
that. Is that rhetorical?
I'll need another abatement system stat. So I don't think that this guy's the problem, but what happens here, the problem arises when the likes of, say, Alex Jones and his InfoWars website, or a blog called The Activist Report, you know, these right-wing blogs, and for our friends on the left side of the political spectrum, there are equally alarmist outlets like a place called Liberals Unite magazine. And what they do, so all ends of the spectrum, they take reports like this and they present them in a way which stirs the emotions and fear and panic in people. And it's usually part of a larger narrative. And in the case of, you know, Alex Jones and Activist Report, you know, all things government regulated or overseen by the government are inherently evil. You know, for a video that might have achieved maybe 50,000 views on its own, has been viewed 750,000 times. And you could probably thank Alex Jones and his viewers and listeners for cranking up those numbers. But what's really going on? Well, as long as you retain some confidence in government agencies, we'll note that just a few days ago, the California Department of Public Health released a statement. And here it is. "There is no public health risk at California beaches due to radioactivity related to events at Fukushima." So radiation detected off the west coast of the United States from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan has declined since the 2011 tsunami disaster. And they actually never really approached levels that posed a risk to human health or to the seafood or wildlife in the area. But, and how are scientists, you know, sure of this? How do they know? Well, one way is that they measure the radiation levels in some of the fish, which swim regularly from the Japanese waters to the U.S. coastline. It's part of their typical migration patterns. And the marine scientists have been tracking the cesium levels in the tissue of bluefin tuna. And these fish come right from Japan, right across the Pacific, and come to the coast of California and Mexico, where they are fished. Radioactive cesium doesn't sink to the seafloor. So what happens is the fish have to swim through it, and they ingest it through their gills or by eating other organisms that have already ingested it. And what they found is that the radiation levels in the fish, as measured since 2011, they have been falling. Now, there are measurable doses of radiation in the fish, but they are very low, and they certainly are low enough that they pose no threat to the species or to the people who eat the fish. But, you know, it doesn't answer what might be causing the high radiation levels that, you know, this fellow from the video and the Geiger counter was picking up. But they did tests. The San Mateo County Public Health Department, along with the California Department of Public Health, did tests, and they showed that the elevated levels of radiation at Half Moon Bay are due to naturally occurring minerals, not radioactivity associated with the Fukushima incident.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So once again, evidence shows otherwise, but the lie got halfway around the world before the truth even got out of bed in the morning.
And then, Evan, to add to that, I think part of the problem is once someone buys into the lie, it puts them at an extreme disadvantage to then adopt the truth. Do you know what I mean? Like once somebody kind of buys into it and maybe they have a little bit of a conspiracy theorist in them, it just sparks up that engine in their head. And then by the time they hear, oh, you know, by the way, that isn't true, I think they'll be much more likely to stick with their original belief.
Sure, especially if it's part of a larger narrative or a larger worldview that they have that supports that worldview. They're less likely to let go of something like this in light of evidence, right? Because it helps prop up their bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. And also what happens is, so there's a big event like Fukushima, and then people are wondering, oh, is all that radioactivity being dumped into the Pacific Ocean going to cause any problems? And then pretty much any environmental problem that cropped up over the next 2 years was blamed on Fukushima. But meanwhile, it's just part of the background of things that are always happening, or there's something else going on. But people, again, they just assume cause and effect because that's the big thing that happened that's in their awareness, in their consciousness. And then that reinforces the belief that there's something going on.
Did you hear the one about the story? In November, it was reported that fish in the Pacific Ocean are so contaminated from radioactivity from Fukushima, it's not only killing the fish, but whatever fish survive and are being catfished and caught and sold to people to eat, we're all being poisoned by radioactive fish. Gary Stamper, he runs a website called Collapse Into Consciousness, a website devoted to surviving the supposed coming collapse of society. Nice. And some of the drivel he offers is, your days of eating Pacific Ocean fish are over. The heartbreaking news from Fukushima is that it's getting worse, a lot worse. It appears that anywhere from 300 to possibly 450 tons of contaminated water that contain radioactive iodine, cesium, and other bad things are flooding into the Pacific Ocean from the Fukushima Daiichi site every
300.
Day. And he says also that to give you an idea of how bad that is, they estimate that the fallout from Fukushima 20 to 30 times as high as the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombings of 1945. So what we have here is another alarmist, same as Alex Jones, who is simply wrong. His facts are not facts at all, and he has a totally warped perspective on this. You know, 300 tons of contaminated water, or even 450, sounds like a lot, right? 300 tons of contaminated water every day. But you know what? The beautiful thing about the ocean is it's vast, and the capacity for it to accept 300 tons of contaminated water a day and disperse it quite nicely among its comparatively near infinite amount of water is quite enough to make sure
that's
that,
nothing,
you know, except for the immediate area. Right. It's nothing. There is estimated to be roughly 19 quadrillion tons of water that occupy the Pacific Ocean. So that sort of ratio, you're not going to get very far. The concentration dilutes rather rapidly the further you get away from the site. Now, the immediate area is of concern. But, you know, the folks in Japan have already stopped fishing in that area, right? And there are all sorts of limitations as to who can go there and whatnot. So they're being prudent about
it. Yeah, we're
not
saying there's no environmental impact from this.
Right.
This wasn't a bad accident, but let's just put it in perspective based on actual facts. Well, speaking of fish, guys going to love this segue. Guys remember Tiktaalik?
Yes.
Yeah. That was a fish.
How could I forget?
It was a fish. It was fishy.
Counts.
So 375 million year old critter is a pivotal piece of evidence for the evolution of sea-based vertebrates to the first walking land-based vertebrates. In fact, this is a great story of the predictive power of evolutionary theory.
Yet again.
Yep. I mean, creationists love to say that evolution doesn't make predictions. That's because they don't understand the science.
What predictions means.
The paleontologist predicted that in Devonian deposits, you know, deposits from around this time, 375 million years ago, that's when fish were evolving into walking creatures. We should find something like Tiktaalik in this strata. And they searched for it and they found it. They found exactly what they predicted they should find there. Mm-hmm. Well,
We have a pretty significant update on this story because that wasn't the end of it, of course. That strata is giving up not just one specimen, but multiple specimens, as you would imagine. If there's one Tiktaalik in the deposit, there should be more. And some of the later specimens. Yeah. Some of the later specimens, have anatomical details that were not present in the earlier ones, specifically the hind legs. Now, Tiktaalik has a pretty large and powerful shoulder girdle, and large fore fins. The fins are still anatomically capable of acting as fins, so they probably primarily used them as paddles, you know, swam around with them. But they're larger, beefier than regular fish fins, and they're anatomically, it looks as if they were capable of scooting along the bottom of shallower, muddy lakes or rivers with those fins. But we didn't know.
Front wheel drive, right?
Yeah, they were front wheel drive, but we didn't know what their hind limbs looked like because the earlier specimens didn't really have good representation of those. So now with the later specimens, they have reconstructed the hind limbs of the Tiktaalik, and guess what they found? They were expecting that the hind limbs would be much smaller, but what they found was that the pelvis was also huge and the hind fins were also huge. So Tiktaalik was probably employed
Four-wheel drive.
It was four-limbed movement. So, and again, it used all of its fins for swimming, but it could walk on four limbs along lake beds or shallow water, or just on the bottom of the water, even if it wasn't shallow. And although they definitely were tied closely to the water, their anatomical structure and that time, in evolutionary history, they were still laying their eggs in the water and feeding in the water and were basically living in the water. But it's certainly possible that they may have scooted from one pond to another across land. I mean, that the limbs would have allowed them to do that. So, it seems that Tiktaalik was just a little bit farther along the path to, quadrupedal, you know, land-based locomotion than the scientists had thought. In that all four limbs are, you know, robust, all four of the fins, you know, capable of contributing to their locomotion, their walking type locomotion. So cool.
Yeah. One thing, Steve, you mentioned earlier specimens and later specimens. In fact, the specimens that you're talking about right now, they were actually gathered at the same time as the original finds. And it's only now that they actually have been prepared and, you know, and studied and things. So my immediate question was, wait, that was like 10 years ago. This is clearly an epically important transitional fossil. You know, what took a decade? Seriously. I mean, maybe I'm being naive and I'm not appreciating the quantity of work, but a 10 years?
It takes a long time to reconstruct fossils and to study them. These were the later ones that were studied and presented, and not necessarily referring to the order in which they were found.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, that's how long it takes, apparently. It's painstaking work.
Gosh, can't you just hear the creationists thinking to themselves, like, oh, those scientists, see what they're doing?
What's our spin now?
They had to reconstruct it, right? They really don't have it. Therefore, they had to kind of make it up as they went along and put together what they think is right. It's not real evidence.
I've heard that. I've heard creationists accuse paleontologists of essentially, you know, sculpting the fossils, not finding them.
Wow.
Or that, or the other thing, the easy way to dismiss this is that it was a fish. That was it. It was just a fish, just like Archaeopteryx was just a bird.
Yeah, a fish with a partial wrist.
Yeah.
Pay no attention to those fine
details.
What use
is a partial wrist?
Apparently some fish had wrists, you know.
Why do they need a wrist?
For watches.
Well, to support the body, Jay. Think about it. I mean, if you could bend the end of your limb, you could support your weight, at least temporarily.
Yeah, it's like supporting yourself on your fingers instead of the palm of your hand.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So Tiktaalik is even cooler than I previously thought. Jay, you are now going to update us on one of the holy grails that we have in medicine, the universal flu vaccine. How close are we getting?
Well, that's a good question. And let's explore this together because I don't know if they really know, but they did throw out the 5 years, you know? So
yeah.
I laughed when I was researching this.
Always.
So many of us regularly get the flu vaccine. I hope more of us than not. In fact, the flu vaccine of today is amazingly similar to the one that they first made back in the 1940s. And the reason why is they really hit on an amazing idea. So the mechanism is that vaccines contain flu antigens or small viral molecules that your body's immune system responds to. It's pretty simple. All flu viruses, though, need a new vaccine. Vaccine manufacturers have to select what flu strains they think will be the ones to hit, and then they make modifications to existing vaccines so they're effective against the latest strains that happen to come out that year. So, you know, they make tweaks to the existing vaccine that they have by studying the flu virus and possibly making some educated guesses on what's going to happen. When new viruses come on the scene, brand new vaccines have to be developed, and this takes time. So I'm specifically talking about when a brand new virus that they've never seen comes out, like the H1N1 or something. Then they have to.
That wasn't brand new. That's been around before. H1N1. That's the swine flu. That's that permutation of antigens on the flu. That was like the 1918 flu. That was the 1970 whatever or swine flu. The H1N1's been around for a while.
So when new viruses come out in the scene, they have to develop a brand new vaccine for them. You know, they don't have the ability to leverage these existing vaccinations and just make the tweaks. They have to start from scratch. And these take a really long time. And unfortunately, a lot of people end up dying or you know, suffering quite a bit from this because the first wave or two of people that get the flu just, you know, of course don't have access to the vaccine. So scientists, of course, have been thinking for quite a long time, you know, can we make a universal vaccine that'll attack any flu virus? But this was really largely out of sight. They didn't think that we were going to get there because research had been done and they weren't making any progress. But a lot of research has been done recently and quite a bit of progress has been made. And now they're saying that we're about 5 years away. That and a whole bunch of solar panels and all these awesome batteries and the flying car and all sorts of other stuff for 5 years out, which we can't wait. Because 5 years from now, everything is going to be so awesome. I just crack up when they do that because 5 years is like a nice round number that a lot of people gravitate to.
One funding cycle. Yeah.
It's true. So to go into a little more detail, it's funny, we had Mark Crislip on here last week, and it would have been great to talk to him about this.
Oh, I know.
But flu viruses mutate very fast, and they change every year. And this means that even slight mutations can make it really hard or impossible for our immune systems to recognize the flu molecules and mount an attack. You know, that's actually what's taking place is our body zeroes in on the virus, kind of does an imprint on it, and then mounts an attack against that specific virus. But a tiny little change, you know, can make it so these past flu experiences and our immune system has, you know, like the knowledge built into it to attack things that it's recently attacked. A little mutation just nullifies that. The part of the flu virus that our bodies recognize and attack are nodules that stick out of the virus, and these are called hemagglutinins.
Mm-hmm.
Think of this like the stem and the top head of a piece of broccoli, right? The hemagglutinins help the virus stick to your cells and their proteins, and this is what our immune systems are actually responding to and react to. Our bodies make the sentinel molecules or the antibodies. I love the term sentinel molecule. This sounds badass. And these are programmed to recognize the hemagglutinin that inspired their creation, and our bodies launch this attack, and it ramps up, and it goes through this whole process where, you know, you're losing in the beginning, and then we kind of, you know, get a foothold, and then we start to kick their ass and everything, and, you know, it's a tail end when you feel like crap, but you can tell you're getting better. That's when your sentinel molecules are starting to really, really come into their own. Minor changes to the shape of the head means a new vaccine needs to be created because our immune systems won't recognize them. But scientists have discovered that mice and humans sometimes make a multi-protective antibody that actually recognizes the stem part, not the head part, the protein, you know, that protein nodule on the end, but it's more of like the stalk that raises it up. And what's awesome is those stalks don't change that much at all during these mutations. They stay relatively the same. So they're developing a way. One of the approaches that they're taking is to attack that stem and not attack the actual protein head, which I think is genius. Now, other scientists are working.
What do you mean attack, Jay?
The antigen, the antibodies will bind to that part of the flu virus. The challenge has been, because I mean, the idea of, oh, let's target the not changing parts of the virus rather than the rapidly changing parts. That's obviously an old idea. I mean, that doesn't take that much brilliance to figure that out. The problem is that the rapidly evolving or changing parts of the virus are the parts that stick out and the parts that have activity. And those are the ones that are easy to target by the immune system. And the parts that don't change that much are not that active, and it's harder to attack them.
Yeah, they were saying that the immune response wasn't as strong.
Yeah, exactly.
To those other parts. And they are working on a couple of other techniques, Steve. One of them is that they want to make antibodies that attack the actual cell body of the flu virus, like the membrane, and then get into the cell. And other teams are developing a strategy that influences the production of our T cells. And the T cells can be thought of as the real heavy lifters of our immune system. And the cool thing about T cells is that they last a lot longer and have a broader effect than the standard antibody. So they are coming up with different techniques. I think that they've been showing some success in their research, but a really big problem, of course, as it comes down, is how much money can they invest into this? You know, the scientists are always looking for more funding and ways to keep their research going and expand their research, but there's been very little research, and I'll tell you why. Because a lot of agencies are saying, well, we have a pretty effective system in place right now. Like, why turn this whole thing on top of its head, start from scratch, and go through this huge FDA process, which could take, you know, amazing amount of time. Like, you know, I'm not talking years. We're talking decades to vet it out like crazy. So it's a very complicated situation. But the fact is, science is now showing that there are bigger and better ways that we could fight the flu virus and maybe defeat the flu virus.
Yeah, I think it'll just slow it down. I mean, we may be able to come up with an effective vaccine that we won't have to update every year. We'll have to update it every 20 years or so.
But wouldn't it be great? You get a vaccine, it stays in your system for many, many years, and it just covers all viruses. You're fine.
Yeah.
You're good to go for a long time.
Exactly. Because as we've discussed, the big problem with the flu vaccine is not that it doesn't work. It's just that we're guessing as to what strains are coming around. And I guess it's really chaotic, you know, like which strains are active at that year. And if we guess wrong, then the vaccine doesn't cover the strains that are actually going around.
Or if they mutate again, by the time they develop the vaccine, you know, we can't just turn around and make a vaccine in 48 hours.
It takes 3 months.
Yeah. And a lot of eggs.
But I've been reading about it for years, about the universal flu vaccine. This is not a new concept. And while I think it's great that they're working on it and these strategies all seem reasonable, when they have one that actually works, then I'll get excited.
Well, I got a quick question. So you got hemagglutinin, right? The flu vaccine has only a portion of the hemagglutinin floating around in it. Your immune system kind of vets it and then gets totally prepared for it. So my question is, if the vaccine only contains a tiny portion of the hemagglutinin, how can the immune system prepare itself to deal with the full-blown hemagglutinin?
All you need is a binding site. That's it. You don't need to have the whole molecule. If you have the binding site, the antibody forms against that binding site. And then when you have the full virus, the antibodies recognize the binding site. They bind to it. That reactivates the B cells in the immune system, and it targets the immune system against that virus. It's just like a little flag saying, come eat me. I'm cool. Foreign. I'm infecting you.
Okay.
The thing is that the mutating locations are the ones that we're targeting with the antibodies, because those are the ones that bind well. Because those are the ones that stick out and have all the activity. Does that make sense? So, I mean, it's possible that one strain is close enough to another strain that there's cross-reactivity, and there's always going to be some amount of cross-reactivity, but there's got to be enough. And the more there is, the more robust the immune response is going to be, and that response has to be robust enough to knock out the infection before it causes a disease, right, before it causes illness. So antibody binding to antigens is not 100% or 0%. It's everything in between. You know, it could be bind a little, it could bind some more, it could bind really well. It's very variable. The better it binds, the more active the immune system will be against it. And then, you know, the immune system goes through a cycle where the B cells that make the antibodies that sort of bind reproduce variations on that theme, and it sort of dials in the binding. You know, It gets more and more specific just through an evolutionary process. But it takes time for that to happen. That's why vaccines work, because you're already primed with the really specific antibodies. But really specific antibodies, of course, will become less specific if there's any mutations in the binding site. And those are the parts of the virus that tend to mutate. Well, guys, let's take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week. This is an oldie but a goodie, GoToMeeting by Citrix.
Yeah, GoToMeeting is a great way to get together with friends or with business colleagues and collaborate online, because you can see each other face-to-face no matter where you're located.
Yeah, I use it a lot at work, and I really like this. It really facilitates meetings, and you could share screens really easy. And just all around a really great way to communicate.
Yeah, the great thing about it is really the simple interface. You know, I've used quite a number of different software that does this type of thing, and we always go back to GoToMeeting. I've been using it, like I said before, I've been using GoToMeeting literally the year that they started. Yeah, the quality is fantastic. You could use it on mobile devices. You could just easily set up your new account, launch it in seconds, and get going on it to test it out if you've never used it before. You could share your screen with collaborators. Documents, spreadsheets. It's just an all-in-one tool that you can use for your meetings. It's fantastic.
And right now, you can start this new year with a free 30-day trial of GoToMeeting. No credit card required to get started. Visit GoToMeeting.com today. Click the Try It Free button and use the promo code SGU. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SGU.
Yep. We even use GoToMeeting sometimes on the show. It really works great. The quality is awesome and we love it. So give it a try. All right, guys, let's get back to our show. Okay. Let's move on. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about Snowden, who apparently, but not really, has now revealed an alien conspiracy.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Snowden released documents proving once and for all that the United States government's foreign policy is controlled by aliens known as tall whites.
As opposed to the medium-sized grays?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. The tall whites. This is according to an Iranian news agency that put out a report on Sunday. The news agency is called FARS, F-A-R-S. And yeah, they claimed that Snowden showed nearly 2 million documents to Russia's federal security services, which confirmed the fact that the tall whites were the ones who were pushing the effort to make a global surveillance system. And the point of that system was apparently to hide the existence of the tall whites who would eventually control the planet. Now, I know you're thinking, what does this have to do with Nazi Germany? Well, I'm glad you asked. The tall whites also helped Hitler. The tall whites helped the Nazis build technologically advanced submarines in order to help them in the war effort.
Yeah, that's where the saying, that's mighty white of you, comes from.
Really?
Yep.
Good. Yep. Seriously, it could be, right? Uh-huh. Don't lie, Steve. Don't put misinformation in my head. Is that the truth?
It's not, but it's equally racist.
Jay, are you serious?
Well, how do I know? I don't know the origin of every stupid saying out there.
It has to do with the white aliens helping Hitler? Do you think that's where it came from?
Well, it could have. Why not?
You know, and southern white people just picked up on it and started using it on a regular basis while oppressing black people. That was just a coincidence.
Same sucks.
Aliens. Are you still talking? I got to get through this fast because Evan and you went on and on and on. So, and this is the most important news story of the week, you guys.
Clearly, you got the winner this week.
So yes, the aliens that were helping the Nazis are now helping Obama himself. He is like leading them. Now, this news service, you should know, also apparently recently reported that a 27-year-old Iranian man invented a time machine. And they also re-reported an Onion article about how white rural voters would rather vote for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad than Barack Obama. So maybe they're not the most truthful. But this isn't the first time that the idea of aliens running the government comes up. Not even the first time that tall whites have come up.
Oh, gotcha.
Because recently, just last week or a couple weeks ago, a former defense minister of Canada went on TV and said that space aliens live amongst us. I'm sorry, not on TV. Wait, was it TV? Russia Today. What is that? That's TV, right?
I don't know.
I think it was on TV.
Duh.
He went on Russia Today and said that the U.S. government is in league with the tall whites. He said that the aliens are in Nevada, and that two women from the tall whites, two alien women, had dressed up as nuns and went to Las Vegas to shop. Because if there's one way to really blend in as aliens, it's to go to Las Vegas dressed as nuns.
Mm-hmm.
He said that they come from all over the galaxy, including Venus, Mars, and Saturn's moon, Andromeda, and other star systems. Mm-hmm.
That was astronomically incoherent.
Yeah. That is correct. Yes. He said that the aliens gave us LED lights and microchips and Kevlar vests. The last thing I find particularly interesting, because I'm pretty sure my grandfather worked at DuPont and helped create the Kevlar vest. So
he was working clearly.
I'm going to have to talk to my dad about this.
Where does Snowden come in all of this?
This was a couple of weeks ago, just from the Canadian defense minister. And then we have the Iranian press reporting that Snowden released secret documents confirming this fact, that Nazi aliens are controlling U.S. foreign policy. But the idea of Snowden leaking things about aliens helping the U.S. goes way back. Last summer, there were several posts and videos from conspiracy theorists. My favorite being a video called Edward Snowden's Secret NSA Surveillance UFO Message, which plays a 30-40 second clip of Edward Snowden talking. And then the last 2 seconds, are the video just reverses like 2 seconds of his speech and claims that it sounds like those UFOs.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
And that's that's how it's proved.
He's like a modern Jesse James Snowden.
And then I also found this great post on AboveTopSecret.com forums.
Ooh, another Alex Jones nightmare.
It would appear
website.
Snowden is revealing UFO secrets. This is back in July. It would appear Snowden is revealing UFO secrets too now. I find it very hard to dismiss him as just another disinfo agent. He claims there is an alien race living in seabed colonies and using submersible spaceships. They don't communicate and are regarded as potentially hostile. And then he links to a website that has since been deleted, apparently. Or at least it's not working for me, but I believe that it's satire.
Yeah.
Can't be sure. But undersea submersible vehicles.
Can't be sure is right.
But yeah, this has been a long-running idea, apparently, that Edward Snowden is releasing documents. No one has ever confirmed such documents, and the Iranian report mentions that he showed the documents to the Russians, while Snowden himself mentioned that he didn't even bring any documents to Russia. And That would make him a disinfo agent. A journalist got in touch with Glenn Greenwald, the journalist who's been working with Snowden, and asked him for comment on the alien conspiracy. And he just responded sarcastically to complain about how the Iranians had beaten him to the punch on the story. Yep.
Gotcha.
Government, aliens, proved, et cetera.
Do you think that the Tall Whites would be a cool band name?
The Tall Whites?
Could be.
I hear the Russians are in league with the Short Rounds. No, nothing.
Was that an Indiana Jones show?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't.
That's right. Well, where's the white Russian jokes that are there to be made?
All right. Thanks, Rebecca.
Yeah, no problem.
I want a quickie with Steve.
Hey. What's that?
That's trademarked.
Well, that's right. I want to step on Bob's toes. But Evan, before we go on to who's that noisy, there was a news item that cropped up just today as we're recording, January 15th, 2014, that I thought I would give just a quick mention to, not a full treatment. This is published in PLOS One, which is an online open access journal. And it is a pretty extensive study looking at the eat right for your blood type diet. This is the blood type diet that was popularized by a naturopath, which basically claims that, like, if you have type A, type B, AB, type O blood type, there's an optimal diet for you. Everybody pretty much on all the diets, except for the type B diet, did pretty well. They had, you know, reduced cholesterol, they lost weight, et cetera. But there was absolutely zero correlation with blood type. Dead negative.
What?
Your blood type makes absolutely no difference to your diet. Shocker.
I'm shocked.
I could have never seen that coming.
But it is good. I do like it when you have nice quality scientific research debunking some bit of nonsense that we've been criticizing for years, you know?
Yeah.
It's good to have that one goes in the list of good skeptical references. All right, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Sure is. I'm going to play for you last week's noisy. And here we go. Last week.
I think we run more risks as a people, as a nation, and as a world without a campaign for reason, science, and critical thinking.
It sounded like a good friend of mine.
I think.
And it was a good friend of mine. It's Leo Igwe.
It is Leo Igwe.
He's an awesome guy.
Yep.
Cool
human
name.
Rights advocate, humanist, former Western and South African representative of the International Humanist and Ethical Union, and has specialized in campaigning against and documenting the impacts of child witchcraft accusations, amongst many other things he is doing. Basically, he's trying to defeat the effects of superstition in Africa and advancing skepticism throughout Africa. No small task in that region of the world.
Yeah, you want to talk about skeptics saving lives? I've seen photos of Leo, like, taking young girls out of places they've been kidnapped from because they were accused of being witches and stuff, and taking them away and getting them into homes. He is a goddamn hero, that guy.
He is. He's, you know, like you said, Rebecca, we don't have to face these kinds of things. We're, you know, in the United States, you know, I mean, not nearly to the extent that people in other parts of the world have to deal with the real absolute horrors that are going on out there. And Leo is doing that kind of work. So great, great work he's doing. Friend of the JREF, friend of TAM, friend of Skeptics Guide. And, you know, we should all pay attention to the work he's doing. Yeah.
Cool.
And there were several correct answers. And this week's winner, Luis Reynoso, frequent listener of the SGU. I recall meeting Luis a few years back at a TAM. Extremely nice fellow. And congratulations, Luis, you are this week's winner. Well done. Good stuff. All right. So moving on.
This week,
we got something pretty cool. Pretty cool. Okay. I'm going to hit you. Easy, easy. Now, what I did is I took the clip and I played it. Well, I repeated it three times, right? So it's one clip repeated three times, just so the audience will have, you know, a little help in hopefully figuring out what this noisy is. So
just like the meat and barber of Seville, you got to grind it three times.
You do. Hey, what an excellent, excellent analogy.
Thank
Steve.
You.
Perfect. Here we go. Okay.
Very interesting.
Yes, very interesting. So I hope people will give it their best guess and email us at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. That's our email for Who's That Noisy contest. Or go ahead and post it on the forums. SGUforums.com is the address there, or the URL, I should say. And of course, good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Let's go on to some email. This one comes from Peter Musey from Seattle. Peter writes, "You said that $1 bills were handled the most and therefore lasted the least time, but according to the Federal Reserve, $5, $10, and $50 bills all have a shorter life expectancy than $1 bills. Though, if I had to guess, I'd say $1 bills are the most destroyed because there are the most of them. but they definitely don't wear out the fastest. Also, I'm pretty sure they don't burn them. They sell the shredded money as souvenirs or for novelties like money-dyed shirts and landfill the rest. Then he gives a bunch of links as sources for his facts. So thanks, Peter. So if you remember last week on The Science or Fiction, we talked about a process for washing money to make it last longer. And we mentioned offhand, you know, that $1 bills, since they're the most common bill, that they get destroyed the most or the quickest. Mainly I'm bringing this up because I had such a hard time verifying what I assumed was going to be a very simple fact. If you go to federalreserve.gov, which is one of the links that Peter offered, indeed they have a table with the life expectancy. They're calling the estimated lifespan of the various U.S. denominations. And they are, for $1, 5.9 years, 5, 4.9 years, 10, 4.2 years, 20, 7.7 years, 50, 3.7 years, and 100, 15 years.
Do you think that's a typo?
$50 is 3.7 years, and $100 bill is 15 years.
How do you go from the $20 bills being 7.7 years down to 3.7 years for the 50 and then back up to 15 years for the 100? I think something's wrong here.
I didn't buy it either. It didn't sit right with me. First of all, they all seem too long.
What's going on here?
And the $50 bill doesn't seem right. So the $100 makes sense, and it does explain in the in some of the resources that I was looking at that people use $100 bills as a store of value. So if you squirrel away some cash, it's probably going to be a stack of hundreds. And therefore, because there's so much stored hundreds out there, the average lifespan of a $100 bill is longer. That makes sense. 50s being the shortest makes absolutely no sense. I don't understand why that is. I don't see 50s that much. They don't circulate that much.
That's why, Steve.
Yeah, but why would that mean? Why would they go back to banks more often? So it's not just how much they're handled. It's also how much they circulate back to banks. Right. So maybe 50s are processed by banks a lot more, and that would make.
Or maybe it's because of those fraud detecting pens that don't actually work. People cashiers are more likely to use them on $50 bills than on any other bill.
Yeah, that possibly. I couldn't find a good explanation for it, but I wasn't satisfied with those numbers. So I went poking around some more, and I found multiple references to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So this is the Department of the Treasury. They have their own figures on the life expectancy of the various currencies, and they're all shorter than what is now listed for the Federal Reserve. And they have the 1, 5, and 10 are all just about the same, but the 5 and 10 are the lowest. And then 20s or more, 50s or more still, and 100s are the longest.
Yeah.
But they're all about half as long as what the Federal Reserve was. They have for the $1 bill 21 months.
And that's in line with what I've read.
Yeah. So I saw links, or I saw references to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing and their table. But when I went back to the BEP website, which is moneyfactory.gov.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They no longer publish that table. They just link to the Federal Reserve. So I don't know if those figures are old, but then I found a link to the Federal Reserve of New York. So you know that there are different Federal Reserve banks. You could look at, there are 12 Federal Reserve districts, you know, and New York is one of those 12 districts, and they list the 21 month figure for the life expectancy of the dollar bill. And they say that this is their own data. Because they're the ones who they say they collect 19 million notes are deposited every day, and they filter out 5 million, you know, unfit currency notes per day.
Do they talk about the 50?
They don't. They don't give as much information, but they do give the 21 month figure for the $1 bill, which is in line with the numbers I found for the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So the information doesn't match. Some of it doesn't make sense. I couldn't find anything resembling an original source, just different banks claiming these are the numbers and they don't match. So maybe one possibility is that the different Federal Reserve banks keep their own figures, and it depends on who you're listening to. You know, New York may have one number, and, you know, maybe a different district has a different number. Who knows where this table that the Federal Reserve is printing comes from. So, and I emailed them to try to get some more data, but
yeah,
of course you did.
They haven't gotten back to me.
They're a little busy.
Haven't gotten back to me. So maybe one of our listeners is an expert and could resolve this mystery for me. I know it's like the most trivial thing that doesn't matter, but it just became a mystery I wanted to solve.
That's why I like it. I like that this listener went and looked it up because he didn't trust us. I love that.
Right.
Steve, now do you think that the rumor that when the tall whites touch a bill, it immediately disappears is true?
Oh, and that's, they are more interested in $50 bills than in any other because there you go.
Yes, because they roll those for their cocaine.
I forget who's on the 50. who's
Grant, on Grant? U.S. Grant.
Grant. You know, right, there was because U.S. Grant is well known as being an alien.
A tall white, yeah.
Tall white. Yeah. All right. One of the burning of money. So, you know, Bob and I think both mentioned that we have memories of seeing huge stacks of cash being burned, and in fact, old bills were burned, but only into the mid-90s. And then the newer inks that are used on the newer bills are too toxic to burn. So they do shred them now. Right. They used to burn them. Now they shred them, and they shred them like into dust.
So it's so that's not too toxic?
So it's not for novelty toilet seats?
Well, then they press them into bricks. Uh-huh. And the bricks are like 1/10 of the volume of the raw shredded bills. And then
what do they do with them?
Then they get landfilled. The bricks get landfilled or made into novelty toilet seats.
Landfills are made of money.
What about all that toxic ink? What the heck's happening to that?
Yeah, but they're not burning it. They're just.
It's just in our water supply.
We're sitting on it. Great.
Yeah.
Shit is always weirder than you think.
Literally.
Isn't it? And that was as far as I could get with the Google, you know. I need an expert to hook
the
up.
Doug Google.
Well, guys, let's take a quick break from our show to talk about this week's sponsor, Squarespace.
Yeah, we still get emails from listeners that are sending us their Squarespace-built websites. We're still reviewing them, and I've yet to see one that wasn't easy and wonderful. The templates on Squarespace are fantastic.
And it's so easy to use. But if you want some help, Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And your website will look good on any device. It even comes with a mobile platform.
Responsive design, Rebecca. How many times have we talked about this?
A million.
Three.
Millions of times.
Or three.
And it's only $8 a month.
Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code SGU1, the number one, SGU1, to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for this SGU.
Yeah, so Squarespace is an all-in-one solution for hosting your website and providing the tools necessary to build your own website for whatever you want, just, you know, showcasing your wares, a blog, or for online selling. Everything you need is there, so check it out, Squarespace. And don't forget to use the offer code SGU1.
And we'd like to thank Squarespace again for their support of the SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Now, this week, we have a special guest joining us for Science or Fiction, Brian Tetro. Brian, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, guys. It's great to be here.
Hey, hey Brian.
Brian.
So, Brian, you are otherwise known by your nim, iPuppy. You got to tell us what the hell that's all about. iPuppy?
I knew you were going to ask. Years ago, We got a gift of one of those magnetic poetry kits, you know, that you put up on your refrigerator and forgot about it for months. And one day I just happened to be looking at the refrigerator and staring right in front of me, it said, iPuppy. And I said, that is pretty darn funny. So I said, well, I might as well register the domain name. So
what else are you going to do?
That is awesome.
Yeah, right. So anyway, that just has been my handle since then.
Okay.
Well, you know, when you Google image search iPuppy, the first result is a robotic puppy saying, love me. So, just FYI. I like it. Awesome. I like it, personally.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
So Brian, I got to ask you a question. This is Jay, by the way. Got to ask you a question. When Evan announced your name, like, what was your response?
I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'd never win anything. So that's what everybody says. I thought back to when I, you know, hit the, I happened to get the right answer for the, who's that noisy? And I said, all year I was kind of thinking, oh, that'd be funny. Okay, my chances are 1 in 52 or maybe even a little bit better because they skip a few weeks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who knows? And then comes the end of the year and there it is. So I was scrambling to read up on all my science news is what I've been doing.
It won't help. Yeah, it won't help.
And now you know how much it sucks, right? Because it's like you got to wait until the last minute because Steve is picking like stuff from like 3 hours ago.
Well, I got to say, I definitely appreciate, one, the preparation you guys all do or the lost cause you guys all have, and then the work that Steve puts into it, you know, every week. Mm-hmm. So, because every article I read, I was like, ooh, how can I make this fake?
It does take a lot of prep work to do a good science or fiction. So, Brian, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Which means
how long have you been listening to the SGU and, you know, what do you think about
it? Tell us about us through your
eyes. It's important.
Well, I started listening to you guys probably about 3-4 years ago. I heard, and I apologize, I heard one of you interviewed or maybe a couple of you were on Point of Inquiry.
Yeah, I was on that show.
Yeah, maybe it was you, Rebecca. And heard that and was like, well, maybe I ought to check this out. And so... So I did, and I didn't start listening and immediately. I had to go back, download like a year's worth. So I spent a few months catching up and then listen to the show on a weekly basis. So a few years, and really, really have enjoyed it. Like a lot of other folks, I'm sure, they tell you, opened up my eyes to kind of a whole new world. I like to think I think a lot clearer and look for evidence. So.
That's nice to hear. You can actually tell us about yourself too. I was sort of kidding. Like, what do you do for a living?
I'm a navigation systems specialist. Work for a big government agency, and I deal with marine navigation systems. Yeah.
Well,
have you heard anything about tall whites recently in the government?
There's no idea what we're talking about. Those are aliens
that control the
government.
This isn't a racist thing.
Are aliens giving us navigation technology? Is that what's happening?
Well, if they are, it hasn't filtered down to us yet, that I can tell. So okay. We're still relying on good old GPS. So,
well, they gave us GPS technology.
They did give us that.
Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah.
Also
maybe.
Kevlar.
And Kevlar. Yeah. Okay.
I can't wait to hear this.
Brian, are you ready for your first science fiction?
Okay, I'm ready.
All right.
Wait, Steve, let's up the ante a little bit because it is pretty monumental that we have him on the show. Like, you know, the first person won the contest, but, you know, hearing about it for a whole freaking year. Mm-hmm. I thought, why don't we set a couple of parameters? One, if all right, this is going to be fun. If Brian sweeps, which is unlikely, but if he sweeps everyone, if he's the only
solo winner, yeah.
Right. Okay. Doesn't happen that often, you know. Happens to me quite a lot, but not, you know, Brian, it's probably not going to happen to you, but if it does, what are we going to do? Let's give him something awesome.
Could be a guest rogue on the show.
Whoa.
Solo win science fiction.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Brian, do you accept those terms?
I do, but thanks for just adding the pressure, you know, even more.
Wait, well, shouldn't there be something to punish him if he loses then?
Wait.
Yes, if Brian is the solo loser, meaning if he picks one item and no one else does, and it's wrong,
then
we'll edit him out of the entire show.
No.
Then Brian has to come to Nexus and massage our backs while we're on stage.
I like that.
You could do that.
I don't even like massages, but I like that.
All right. Sounds like a plan. All right.
There we go. And it begins.
It's kind of a package deal. Here we go. Item number one. A new study reexamines classic moral dilemma psychology scenarios using virtual reality, finding that subjects are more utilitarian, basing decisions on outcomes rather than moral reasoning, when facing the scenarios in virtual reality than when simply asked what they would do. Item number two, a recently published study finds a so-called obesity paradox. Overweight or obese patients with type 2 diabetes survive longer than their normal weight counterparts. And item number three, new research finds that even the oldest trees grow faster and store more carbon as they age. Brian, as our guest, I'm sure you know by now that it is your distinct privilege going first.
Okay, let's see. New study reexamines classic moral dilemma psychology scenarios. So I assume those are things that were common things that are used to put people in a moral dilemma, but they use virtual reality and their decisions are more utilitarian. That sounds reasonable. So that could be. Next one, a recently published study finds a so-called obesity paradox. Overweight or obese patients with type 2 diabetes survive longer. Now, type 2 diabetes, I think that's the more common one and more, chronic, but that may be. But obesity paradox, I hadn't heard anything about that. That sounds a little fishy, so I'm not so sure. New research finds that even the oldest trees grow faster and store more carbon as they age. I'm thinking about, you know, like the rings on trees, and if they get further apart, or closer together, I guess, but that more depends on the environment they're in. So that's not really a clue. So, boy, I honestly have no clue on any of these. All that studying I did just totally went out the window.
Welcome to my world.
You learned a lot along.
Three-sided coin.
You learned a lot along the way, though.
Yeah. I think number two is correct. That rings a bell, and it seems the paradox part. So, sounds reasonable. So I think we're down to between one and three, or the first one and the third one, the moral dilemma, virtual. I think that's true. So I think number three is the false one. The oldest tree is growing faster and storing more carbon as they age.
Okay, Rebecca.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, I like Brian and I want him to be a guest rogue. And the only way that can happen is that I absolutely cannot choose the tree one as the fiction. So that is off the table. I'm hoping that the rest of the panel follows suit here, because I want Brian to either be a guest rogue or I want him to be giving us massages at Nexus. So I'll take either.
I know, my feet are killing me.
And for that reason, I believe that trees do in fact grow faster and store more carbon as they age. And I can see it happening. Old growth forests are known to be much more important to the biodiversity of an environment. So, and trees are like immortal, right? I think trees are maybe immortal. So there's no reason why they should get weaker as they age. So that leaves me with the moral dilemma and the obesity paradox. I assume the moral dilemma is the old, there's a train and it's driving straight towards a bunch of people. You can flip a switch and have it move to another track and hit only one person. Do you do it? And it's interesting because the utilitarian outcome would be flipping the switch, but most people find that too much. Like they feel like they are then actually killing that person because they have to do something. And that's usually how people answer in those sort of situations. Like, well, I wouldn't switch the train even though I would save more people. So it's interesting that in a more realistic environment, the subjects would be more utilitarian. And this other one doesn't make any sense at all. Obesity paradox. Overweight patients survive longer than normal weight patients. With type 2 diabetes, I'm not buying that at all. That seems like I could believe overweight, because overweight people sometimes have advantages. I know when it comes to like elderly people, it can be good for them to be maybe a little overweight than underweight. But obese, I think I'm going to have to say that one's the fiction.
Okay. Bob?
Okay. The tree one. Time's up.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you spent all your time on the news items. So.
Yeah, right.
I'm not gonna let it go.
The tree one, I'm buying that. I can't think of any. Nothing's jumping out at me. I'm not finding any problems. So I'm going to focus on the other two. The moral dilemma one makes perfect sense to me. You know, you're in a virtual reality scenario, and I could see you being more practical and goal oriented because it's right there in front of you. The obesity one makes absolutely no sense. I agree with Rebecca on that. It's just like, and for that reason, I'm kind of tempted to take that one, because it's just like too obvious. Now, Steve, now I assume you mean that the normal weight counterparts mean they have normal weight and they have diabetes. They have type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, controlled for in every other way.
I'm going to go with the obesity as fiction.
Okay, Evan?
The trees. So I can't choose that one because of what Rebecca said.
Who speaks for the trees?
Classic moral dilemma psychology scenario does seem to make sense. Yeah, rather than moral reasoning, I think so. I think different parts of our brains are probably firing in a virtual reality scenario as opposed to just answering a question. I can see us doing a deeper dive, as they say. Well, obesity paradox, that given the two choices, that one's probably the fiction.
Okay, and Jay.
All right, so this first one here about the moral dilemma business. Now, clearly, if I'm playing a 3D video game where they're testing me and they're seeing the outcome, and there's a bunch of tall whites standing there, and a train is about to drive right over them.
Now, just to be clear, you are talking about alien life and not
That's
tall
true,
white
but
people.
I would take the utilitarian
route. Oh,
now
route. I get it.
I would take the utilitarian route, and I would just pick the train that kills them the most and go with that one. I'm not going to care morally what happens to these bastards.
Jay, the experiment is there are five tall whites on one track and Adolf Hitler on the other.
Yes.
That's the thought experiment.
Yes, and my solution is the word yes. So anyway, yeah, I could see, you know, I was
Brian, this is going to be hilarious when you listen to the whole episode.
So now this whole thing about the obesity paradox, there's nothing about it that makes sense. Like, no.
That's why it's a paradox.
No. But
it's two docs.
I can't think of anything that would make that false. I think it is, in other words, I can't think of anything that make it right, so it has to be false. That is a false statement.
There you go.
Okay.
I do not agree that there is an obesity paradox. I think it was just, you know, poorly run studies or people that were doing wishful thinking for whatever. So I think that one's the fake.
All right. So all the rogues think that the obesity paradox is the fiction. And Brian, you are all by yourself in thinking that the old growth trees is the fiction, which means that all of you agree about the first one. A new study reexamines classic moral dilemma psychology scenarios using virtual reality, finding that subjects are more utilitarian, basing decisions on outcomes rather than moral reasoning, when facing the scenarios in virtual reality than when simply asked what they would do. And this one is. Now, this is based on the classic trolley experiments.
I love this new pattern.
So where you're right, Rebecca.
Awesome.
I've noticed that, Evan. That,
yes, I like it.
You have the five people on one side, one on the other. You're heading towards the five. Do you throw the switch and kill the one actively rather than passively killing the five? And even though when you think about it, it's like, well, of course you're just going to kill just one person instead of five, but people have this gut feeling that they don't want to be actively responsible for the death of somebody else. But they will flip the switch more often than they will say, push somebody off of onto the tracks in order to save the five people. So that's a little bit too active for people. They won't do that. But this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Everyone's still alive.
The beautiful thing about this game is you're always right once.
So
at least once.
They actually have, you can go online. We'll have the links. You could see like a video of, like, it's a video game, basically, of the classic trolley experiments. And there's five people strolling along on one side and one on the other side, and you can kill the five or you can kill the one. And will you hit the button or flip the switch or do whatever it takes? And people,
most boring video game ever.
Yeah, we're more likely to
tic-tac-toe, to
hit the button, to do the active thing and kill the one person. The researchers who were doing this study, first of all, it's very interesting because they caution that we have to be very careful in interpreting the results of these classic experiments because it might be artifactual. You know, you're just asking somebody to think abstractly, what would you do? And they engage their moral reasoning in a way that really doesn't reflect the immediate decision that you would have to make in the real life scenario. Whereas in the video game, it's more real life. There it is. You're barreling down the tracks. You only have a certain amount of time. You got to make a decision. Do you hit the switch? And people are much more likely to go with their immediate reaction, which is the utilitarian one, rather than the more thought out reaction, which engages more with our instincts, you know, our feelings about it, the feeling that I don't want to do something active, you know, to kill somebody. Okay, let's move on to number two. A recently published study finds a so-called obesity paradox. Overweight or obese patients with type 2 diabetes survive longer than their normal weight counterparts. There's a lot riding on this. Jay, your perfect record is at stake.
I didn't think about that.
It's totally at stake here. Brian, is it, you know, what? Guest rogue versus uncomfortable live massage? You know,
hey, nobody said anything about it being uncomfortable.
For him, it'd be uncomfortable for him. All right. And
my current spotless record of zero wins,
which you're looking to break,
is a threat. Yeah.
So the obesity paradox is the fiction. Sorry, Brian.
Brian. Then you're paying for your own travel and hotel costs.
I'm not going to shower for 2 weeks before that show.
Which isn't anything special.
Brian, the good news is, in all seriousness, we are giving you a free ticket to Nexus.
Oh, wow. Great. Thanks.
I don't know. Where do you live?
You do still have to get there.
Baltimore.
Yeah, I'm in Baltimore. Well, so it's not that far.
That's a train ride.
Yeah.
What's that Baltimore line you said?
I was considering going. So,
And make no mistake, we will drag you up on stage.
You will go up on stage.
I have no doubt.
All right. So in this study, so earlier preliminary studies did suggest that there was this obesity paradox, that overweight or obese diabetics were living longer than their normal weight counterparts. And, you know, you could make sense of that in certain ways. They have nutritional buffer there, and, you know, diabetics can go into a diabetic coma if they don't have the caloric reserve. That could be more dangerous for them, whatever. But this study, which actually does make more sense, this is a large study, 3,083 deaths, you know, were followed during a 15.8 years of follow-up. And they found now there was a little bit of a difference between smokers and non-smokers. For those who never smoked, there was just a linear curve. You know, the more overweight you were, the shorter you lived. So that kind of makes sense. For smokers, there was a slightly J-shaped association. So among smokers, though, there was a little bit of a dip before the mortality went up. So overall, especially in the obese categories, the obese patients had lower survival or higher mortality in both groups, which means that new research finds that even the oldest trees grow faster and store more carbon as they age is science. And this also reverses what was previously thought. It was previously thought that when trees got really old, they didn't grow as fast. They started to slow down in their old age. But a recent review of multiple different species of trees finds that this is based upon repeated measurements of 673,046 individual trees, some going back more than 80 years. And they find that trees continue to grow faster as they age, even the oldest trees that were studied. The bigger the tree, the more leaves they have, the more sunshine they can convert into energy, the more bigger root system they have, and, you know, the more substance they have, you know, in order to produce more tree. So it kind of makes sense that they would gain more mass, sequester more carbon just because they're bigger. And I guess the other variable of just like their metabolic rate, it doesn't offset that. So even old trees are still metabolically active enough to grow faster than younger trees. All right, Jay, you kept your perfect record. Rebecca, you're on the board. Got a score on the board.
Broke Sweet. The streak.
Brian, we'll see you at Nexus.
Yeah, I fell into the old reverse psychology trap, looking at the one that looks the most false and saying, nah, that's got to be the true one.
Yeah,
I've never been there. Do that. Never do that.
I've been there.
You did great anyway, Brian.
Absolutely, Brian.
Thanks, Rebecca, guys. It was a lot of fun, a lot of anticipation. Just great to just have the chance to chat with y'all.
Yep, it's the journey, not the destination, as we say. So.
The destination being Jay's disgusting, unwashed, sweaty shoulders.
Yeah, right? You'll love it. Just trust me, they all do.
That's called an unexpected journey.
And stick around for the very end. Jay's going to give us a quote.
I got this quote from someone on Facebook, but I'm specifically asking people to not submit quotes to me over Facebook just because I don't check my Facebook messages that often, but I see my email all the time. So email it to us at info@, or you can go on our website and send it specifically for the quote. But anyway, Magnus Meyer sent me this really cool quote from George Santayana. And George Santayana was a philosopher, an essayist, a poet, and a novelist. And the quote is, "The line between what is known scientifically and what has to be assumed in order to support knowledge is impossible to draw. Memory itself is an internal rumor."
George Santayana!
Yes. His most famous quote, of course, being, "Those who forget our history are condemned to repeat it."
Gosh, I forgot that.
So at TAM 2013, Chris Berry, one of the players, he was one of the top winners, and he unfortunately cannot make it to Nexus because he lives so amazingly far away. So he contacted me and Steve and said, "Hey, I'd really like to donate my ticket to Nexus. You know, we'll donate it to a student, though we're going to ask people that are interested to possibly win his free ticket to Nexus." And of course, this includes your entry to everything that's happening at Nexus, but you will have to pay for your airfare and travel or whatever. Please submit a blog post, a skeptically based blog post, to us at info@, with the subject Nexus blog post. And what we'll do is we'll read through all of them, and the winner will actually get published on Steve's neurological blog, and you'll get the ticket to Nexus.
Nice.
And the deadline is March 1st. All right, guys. Thanks for joining me all this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
Yep, Brian, thanks for joining us. And congratulations again.
Oh, yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.